Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with Ian Dark, John Rawling and myself, Tris Dixon. Guys, thank you so much for taking the time to tune in to our podcast. The feedback has been nothing short of outstanding via your reviews on iTunes and Spotify. So thank you very much for doing them. This week, we are talking about none other than the greatest Muhammad Ali. Let's start. And I think we'll talk about our dealings or lack of dealings with Muhammad Ali later on. I think, Ian, you might have been the only one that worked with him. But in terms of go-to stuff, which we talked about doing an episode on YouTube in the near future, what is your favorite Muhammad Ali fight? If you had to have one in a desert island disc Ali fight, what would you take?
Well, there are so many, aren't they? I mean, it's such a wonderful story, a story for the ages. But, you know, I'm going to go past the obvious. Obviously, you know, Thriller in Manila, Rumble in the Jungle, you know, beating Sonny Liston to win the title in the first place. But I'm going to go to the fight. And I think this is something any boxing purist or aficionado should watch and probably already have watched. The fight against Cleveland Williams in 1966. Because watch Ali there. There's a heavyweight with the speed of a middleweight. His precision, his accuracy, his liquid movement. It was just a beautiful performance to watch. And I've read the quote many times about that fight. On that night, I don't think any fighter in any era could ever have beaten. He was that brilliant. It was just wonderful to behold if you're a fan of this sport. So I'm going to pick that one.
John, how about you?
Ian stole my thunder. I was going to go the same way, but I'll think on my feet and go elsewhere. But while you're talking about that Cleveland Williams fight, I mean, I'll tell you something else about that fight. That overhead picture of a spread-eagled Cleveland Williams with Ali standing over him as the victor is perhaps one of the truly iconic photographs of Muhammad Ali's career. But I mean, the fight, I think, I acknowledge what Ian said. 1966, I think he was just on a different level to any heavyweight before or since. But I think, one of the quotes that he came out with is, and which he stood by, is the will must be stronger than the skill. And I think that there was an awful lot of that about Zaire when he beat George Foreman. You know, I mean, he had a great tactic, the rope-a-dope tactic, which we all know about. Foreman tired out. Ali went on to knock him out and to stop him. But I think what was incredible about Ali was his self-belief. And that was never more evident than the whole Kinshasa experience. He was just amazing. He captivated a nation and the world watched in awe. You know, oh my God, he's won it back at 32, as Harry Carpenter famously said.
Yeah, it was a great line, wasn't it, of Harry's that. You know, that's got to be, I don't know what you think, Tris, the most audacious strategy any fighter has ever come up with for a fight. I'm going to go in now with one of the biggest punches in the history of world boxing. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to lay on the ropes and let him have a go at hitting me and trying to get through my sort of crisscross defense and see. I mean, to do that, thinking on his feet, and I think he did think on his feet doing that and just let Foreman punch himself out. I mean, it was outrageous, really. I'm sure Angelo Dundee must have been in the corner there looking at that, thinking, what the hell are you doing?
Didn't they loosen the ropes to try and help Ali do that? I think Ali myths, but they loosened the ropes so that he could go to the ropes and sort of lie back and make Foreman do more work and reach more and everything else. But yeah, I mean, what a plan. I'm going to go in with this guy that throws throws hand grenades and sit there until he runs out, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the football equivalent of that would be, say, we're going to give Lionel Messi the ball as often as possible and just see if we can try and stop him.
Yeah, I like that.
What would yours be, Tris?
I actually had Cleveland Williams as well, and I remember watching it as a young amateur, and I was thinking, you know, you can't. When I closely watch boxing, I try and put myself in each fighter's shoes for a period of time. And I was putting myself in Ali's shoes and thinking, this looks really easy. Why can't I do this? And then I was putting myself in Cleveland Williams' shoes and I was thinking, you can't do anything with this guy. You can't hit him. You can't hurt him. You can't track him to the corners. You can't stop him from hitting you when he wants to hit you. And I just thought that was incredible. But like you, John, if I had to think on my feet and go to a second one, I would actually go to a loss. And I would go to the first fight with Joe Frazier in Madison Square Garden. Just because of it was just two guys very near their peak. You could obviously argue that Ali had had his time away from the ring by that point and was coming back, but they were about as close to their peak as they were going to get in terms of their fight with one another. And you couldn't tell that Ali had had that layoff, really. You know, he'd obviously come back and he'd beaten Jerry Quarry and Oscar Bonavina before he fought Frazier, which are two very useful comeback opponents, you know, top 10 guys, really. And he was brilliant, and he got, you know, he showed, you know, the heart and the guts to get up from that Frazier left hook late in the fight, and you know that famous flashbulb left hook. And yeah, it was just an outstanding fight and outstanding performance from both guys. And I mean, some people do contend that win by Joe Frazier is arguably the biggest win and the best win in boxing history to beat someone a near prime Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, you could argue
it was the biggest fight of all time, couldn't you?
Yeah.
But I think when we were talking the other day, you came up with another one, didn't you? That Joe Louis Max Schmeling one in 1938, given everything that was going on in the world around that time, the German against an American on the eve of the Second World War, the Hitler and all that sort of thing. That might take the biscuit, but that might be a subject for another podcast another day. But yeah, that fight, that just reminds me of a story. I mean, we were talking about that fight, standing outside Madison Square Garden in the freezing cold, doing a live piece to camera one day. And I had this New Yorker guy who was like standing right next to me. And I'm talking about this was where they staged, you know, one of the great fights of all time, March the 8th, 1971, Ali against Frazier. And the guy's talking all the time and I'm live on air. I can hear this guy saying, can you hear this limey talking about the fight? He wasn't at the fight. He wasn't there. Was he talking about the limey? I saw better fights in the garden than that. And he went through all these fights. He's talking to his mate. It's all coming out on air on Sky.
That's great. I mean, yeah. I mean, the thing was, obviously, they called it the fight of the century. And it was one of the very few that can live up to that tagline, wasn't it? Whether it had the social implications of a Louis Schmeling, obviously, you can't be sure. But it certainly wasn't without its social implications, though, given the landscape at the time and the environment that was that it was played out in. Yeah, sorry, Ian.
I was going to say, Frazier was one of the very few people on the planet who didn't like Muhammad Ali, did he? I mean, and you can look back now on the kind of taunting that Ali did and say, you know, by modern PC standards, it was pretty far over the line, wasn't it, really? Because, you know, he was denigrating him in a way that was, well, it went beyond just boxing hype, didn't it? I mean, but it was all to sell the fight as far as Ali was concerned. Not that it needed a lot of selling, but some of the stuff he came out with about Frazier left him extremely bitter. And I don't think he ever truly forgave Ali, despite their three fights and everything that they went through and despite the money they made together. But, you know, that was kind of sad.
You mentioned the hyperbole. You mentioned, you know, the brash Ali. I am asking you guys for a favorite Ali quote. There's obviously so many. I think probably the one that caught my imagination most as a kid was where he said, I'm so fast that last night I turned off the light switch in my hotel room and I was in bed before the room was dark. I think maybe at the time, I was so young when I first read that, I actually thought that was the truth. But yes, I mean, there were so many obviously great Ali lines. John, did you have a favourite?
Well, one which really made me laugh. There was a commentator at the time called Howard Cassell, who was noted as a man who wore a wig. And Ali once on live television said, "Howard Cassell, I know you're a phony because the hair on your head's from the tail of a pony." But there's another one later where, you know, I mean, there were a lot when he was sort of finished fighting and he was thinking about what he'd done and what was important in life. And a beautiful one I came across was, "Impossible is just a word thrown around by small men who find it easier to live in the world they've been given than explore the power they have to change it. Impossible is not a fact, it's an opinion. Impossible is temporary, impossible is nothing." I think that's wonderful.
Ian, where are you with that? Have you got any? I know I've asked you on the fly here.
I'm not sure I can match your Muhammad Ali quotes right off the top of my head, but, you know, I mean, just a couple of things that he said rung through the ages sort of with me, like sitting there completely exhausted after the rumble in the jungle with David Frost doing the interview. Do you remember that? And the line he came out with is, "Never write me off till I'm about 50. You know, that just kind of, that's just rung into my head many times. And of course, you know, I mean, some of the things he said have almost like passed into the boxing lexicon about, like, "I'm going to, you know, shock the world." You hear people say that today, don't you? At every heavyweight title fight, "I'm going to shock the world." You know, and the "float like a butterfly, sting like a bee." You know, that's almost passed into the language, that stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking that exact same thing. You talk about a guy who transcends the sport. You know, like you said, that's in the popular lexicon, isn't it? Popular dictionary of terminologies that are used today. Although there was a more humorous one, wasn't there? There was a tongue-in-cheek one, wasn't there? There was a "float like a something and sting like a something else." It was something like float like an anchor and sting like something else. I can't remember,
But that was Buster Douglas when he fought and defended the title after beating Tyson against Amanda Holyfield. And we should credit the writer who came up with it, because it was brilliant. And it was, "float like a buffalo, sting like a gnat."
Oh, dear. That's great stuff. That's great stuff. So what made Ali unique? And John, I'll start with you. I mean, was it just his fighting style? Was it the fact that he had this incredible rebirth in 1970 after his very public stance against the war in Vietnam? Or was it the stance itself? Or was it his character? What made Ali Ali?
He was so multifaceted, wasn't he? He was a wonderful boxer. And when his sheer speed started to erode, he showed he'd got the most extraordinary will to win and unfathomable depths of bravery to carry him through fights. But, I mean, I remember as a little boy, Muhammad Ali was unquestionably above anybody my hero. And if there hadn't been a Muhammad Ali, I would never have done what I've done in boxing, I don't think. I wouldn't have been a commentator and a journalist. It just wouldn't have happened. He inspired a young kid, you know, and I was just a little boy from the East End of Sheffield who'd I don't think I'd ever met a black man in Sheffield at that time of my life. And yet this guy from Louisville, Kentucky, who was a completely, you know, just completely miles and miles away from where I was as a little boy, he became my ultimate hero. And I think it was a combination of athletic brilliance and just sheer charisma. You know, let's be honest about it. I mean, he was a beautiful physical specimen. Physically, athletically, he must have been well nigh perfect. But if you add to that the sheer brilliance of his the way he articulated everything he wanted to do, everything he promised it would happen, I think that was an incredibly attractive thing for a young kid. And then, of course, there was the the time out of the ring when he didn't go to Vietnam. And I think in the 1960s, he was massively popular in Europe and in Britain. And he'd prospered over here because he wasn't particularly popular in the United States. You know, I mean, he was very much part of the civil rights movement and the black Muslim movement. And I think at the time in the 60s, that alienated a lot of Americans. And it was after he'd made a stance on a point of principle that he captivated young America, young, intelligent, red America. He went and spoke at the universities and captivated a whole new audience. And when he came back, he wasn't just a brilliant fighter, but he was somebody who people admired because he'd stood up against the system and he'd said things which a lot of people would have liked to have said, but perhaps didn't have the balls to say it.
Ian, how about you? What made Ali stand out to you? Can you top that? I mean, I will say this, actually, in terms of John talking about Ali's popularity, is, you know, there was a period of time where he wasn't the beloved figure that he became. And in fact, that rematch with Sonny Liston, which was in Lewiston, Maine.
Yeah.
Do you know what the attendance was for that? 2,434 people went to see Ali Liston too. Can you imagine that today? A heavyweight title fight with barely 2,000 people in. Extraordinary, but it goes to show that he wasn't the man of the people back then.
Well, that's right. I mean, he was, for a time, very unpopular in America, and particularly during the time, you know, after the draft dodging and the ban from boxing. And, I mean, they wanted to jail him, but he appealed against that. I mean, I think there was a 5-year jail sentence imposed, first of all, and they appealed and won against that. But yeah, he was a persona non gratis. He was regarded as somebody who turned his back and was, you know, betrayed America by not going to fight in Vietnam. Well, the rest of the world thought that the American journey into Vietnam was questionable, to put it mildly. What were they doing there? And they didn't feel the same about that war, of course. And in the end, you know, opinion changed. But but what made Ali what he was? I think you've got to remember when he came through. We just have, you know, the Second World War, the 50s, very austere time, and Ali came along, well, as Cassius Clay originally, of course, you know, around the time TV was becoming as big as it was. You know, Kennedy had just won the first real TV US presidential election. The Beatles, he was part of that whole 60s scene. Suddenly, this sportsman came along who was like nobody else that you'd ever seen before. You know, he was a guy who could make punching look like poetry, balletic, gliding, electric, oozing this charisma, flashy, funny, making these predictions. Like John said, I think, you know, there were people who weren't even interested in boxing who would watch on Saturday lunchtime on Grandstand because they put on those fights from America with Don Dunphy doing the commentary at about 1 o'clock. And you could see Clay, you know, he predicted he's going to, you know, winning so many rounds against Sonny Banks and all these people and Doug Jones and whatever it was. And nearly always he was right. And then he was, you know, so entertaining in the interview afterwards. And he just captured everybody's imagination even before he became champion. So, you know, and everything that happened afterwards, I mean, what a story it all is, that the whole thing with the draft dodge, the rebound from that, you know, the impossible win against Foreman, the amazing fight, third fight with Joe Frazier. So, yeah, there it is. You know, and you know what sums it all up to me? What sums up to me is when they had the vote for the sports personality of the century on the BBC, Ali won it hands down. And there wasn't any argument from anybody else that anyone else might have even been a contender alongside him.
Fair comment.
Going back to just, well, think about that and about, you know, about what made him special. He meant so much to so many young people at that time. You know, I was a kid watching that. I remember it's one of my earliest sporting memories, getting up and watching him, watching with my dad when he fought Sonny Liston. That's one of my earliest sporting memories ever. But he, you know, to say how much he meant, I remember when he lost to the first time when he lost to Ken Norton by split decision, had his jaw broken in, I think it was 1973. I mean, I can remember as a young lad there, I was in tears. I was crying because Muhammad Ali had lost. It meant as much as that. It was just, you know, I've never remotely felt as passionately about anything in sport as I did about watching Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, I mean, when he lost to Frazier, I remember the world was certainly in Britain. People were really sad about it, that he'd lost that fight.
I remember, you know, like the thing I think that I find particularly captivating about Ali is the contrast between good and bad, good and evil, whatever you want to call it, and popularity and lack of popularity is the swings and the turns and the twists through the story. You got to remember, obviously, when he fought my old buddy Ernie Terrell, and he tortured Ernie and was saying, you know, Ernie had said, and I know Ernie's side of the story, having spent a lot of time with Ernie over the years. Ernie knew, as he was then, Cassius Clay as a young amateur coming up, and they were friends together. They would drive around the neighborhood in Chicago together. So Ernie always knew him as Cassius Clay. And when he saw him again, he called him Cassius because that's what he knew him as. It wasn't a slight on his religion as such, although obviously Ali took it that way. But obviously then he ended up punishing Ernie in the ring, saying, you know, what's my name? Say my name and all the rest of it. You know, but to paraphrase one of the earlier quotes, pulling the wings off a butterfly, really. It was like that, really, the way he tortured poor Ernie. And then when you look at the draft and the fallout, I suppose one thing that echoes through the ages is that he's taken such a huge stance on an important social issue, and how we would probably long for our heavyweights today to take a similar stance about things such as Saudi Arabia and other things like that, or to have an opinion on something. Unfortunately, it seems to be left to other sportsmen, because we seem to have a more robotic heavyweight scene at the moment than the dazzling, dashing personality of Muhammad Ali, who wasn't upset to not conform, I suppose, in many ways, right, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, you've got a point, but you know, who really can compare with Ali? That's the other thing. Whoever has been like him, in you know, so to compare today's boxers and ask him to be like Ali, it's impossible. I mean, he was lightning in a bottle.
So obviously we talked about him missing the 3 years, which is extraordinary in its own right, in the sense that he came back and had he's had two Hall of Fame careers, really, one before the draft and one afterwards, which in its own right is basically unique. But missing the 3 years, he came back and then fought the likes of Frazier three times, Norton three times, Foreman, Bugner, Jimmy Young, Richard Dunn, and then obviously went into the latter stage of his career, Ernie Shavers, and so forth. John, was there a perfect time for Ali to have bowed out? Is there a time? Obviously, we're aware that the fights at the end there with, in particular, Larry Holmes and Trevor Burbick were absolutely disgusting, revolting, and you know, just not good for boxing at all. But when would you have liked to have seen Ali walk away?
Well, we missed his prime, didn't we? You know, he'd fought Cleveland Williams, Zora Foley. Then he's out until 1970. I think that time he was out of the ring, I think he would have absolutely 100% have had two or three years there at his very peak. Because when he came back, much as we like to see, you know, he looked like Muhammad Ali and he could still do some of the things that Muhammad Ali used to do. But really, he was a different fighter, wasn't he? He was surviving on ring craft, bravery, and massively his ability to take a punch. You know, and looking back, I think if you could look at the thing with the 2020 vision of hindsight, I think you'd certainly have said after Manila, they both just absolutely destroyed each other in the ring, I think that would have been the time to walk away. Although, you know, I mean, Ferdy Pacheco, who was the ring physician, he quit the camp after doing tests on Ali after the Ernie Shavers fight in 1977, which was another brutal fight, and he found that Muhammad Ali's motor functions were deteriorating then, and he advised him you have to get out of boxing. You know, you are doing yourself irreparable damage by continuing. He chose to walk away. He was a very, very educated medical man. And I think if Ferdy Pacheco said 1977 was enough, then that certainly was enough. He shouldn't have had the fights against Spinks. He shouldn't have had the Holmes fight, the Burbick fight. But I think for me, I'd have liked to have seen him get away after Manila.
Yeah. You mentioned Zora Foley there while you were talking, John, and just reminds me of one of the Ali stories was, you know, he could have a cruel, nasty streak, as Tris has described, you know, the What's My Name fight over 15 rounds beating up Ernie Terrell. But after he'd beaten Zora Foley, he'd noticed before that Foley's little boy, who was about 7, was sitting at ringside. And after he'd won the fight, Ali went down and sat alongside him for a moment and said, "I want you to know, although your dad lost tonight, your dad was a great fighter. Your dad was, never forget that. Your dad was a great fighter." And I thought, well, that kind of showed his sort of a lovely side he had to him, Ali. And I mean, the other one was, I mean, Angelo Dundee tells that story about how they sent him out to do a sort of little bit of a PR trip. He went to an old people's home in Miami when he was coming through, you know, and he was making his way before he was champion. And he was asking the old people there. He said, do you see my fights on the TV? And they said, we don't have any TV. So within a week, 95 TVs had arrived for all the rooms of the old people's home with a note saying, "Now you can watch all my fights on TV." I mean, apart from everything we've talked about, he was a lovely guy. But, there wasn't that second phase of his career. And, one of the very first fights I ever covered was the Larry Holmes fight in Las Vegas. I'd never been to America. I'd never, you know, really covered boxing properly. And there I found myself covering Muhammad Ali in Vegas, which was extraordinary. But he fooled us all. You know, he looked $1 million beforehand. And he said, you know, he was going through all the jive talk and saying, like, when have you ever seen me lose when I look like this? And, you know, just like it always was. But everybody wanted to believe that there'd be one more miracle, including rather disgustingly Don King. Yeah, I mean, you're right, John. It's obvious he should have retired after Manila. You know, looking back on it with hindsight, he should have. That was the perfect way to go out. But, you know, the Holmes fight is the saddest sporting thing I've ever seen. People in the crowd were crying. I remember a guy behind me saying, "Don't do this to me, Ali. Don't do this to me, Ali." He was in tears watching it. Went on too long.
Where were you sat for that, Ian? Were you right at ringside? Or were you a few rows back?
I didn't have a great seat because we weren't doing commentary. I was sent to do reports for BBC Radio Sport. And for some reason, we didn't have the commentary rights to do that. So I didn't have the greatest seat. But, you know, like, I was near enough to watch what was a systematic beating. And I mean, and there were quotes afterwards, like Larry Holmes saying, like, "I didn't want to do this to you," because, you know, they'd been sparring partners and mates in the past. I remember Ali with dark glasses on and looking shocking at the press conference afterwards saying, "Why did you do this to me then? You seem to enjoy it." I mean, he still had his sense of humor, but, you know, goodness knows what damage was caused that night. Bundini Brown in the corner was disgusting, really. I think he was an influence in keep letting it go on. And you'd have to say Dundee too. They should have pulled him out. But, you know, he'd pulled off so many outrageous things in his career that I think that's why they let it go on, believing against everything, all the evidence in front of them, that somehow he'd produce some kind of miraculous escape from it all. And it was very obvious to everybody that he certainly wasn't going to be doing that night.
Let me ask you this. Sorry, Ian, while we're on this, what was the mood like in the audience? Obviously, you mentioned the chat behind you saying, you know, what he was saying. Was it a somber occasion? Was it, you know, was everyone just, you know, aghast with what was going on?
Yeah, they called it the last hurrah. It was outdoors at Caesar's Palace on one of those balmy, sultry nights that you get there. And yeah, there was a great sadness, I would say, that hanging in the air over what was happening. It was almost like avert your eyes. a terrible thing to watch. I mean, why the referee didn't step in as well, but I guess because it was Ali again, you know, the referee didn't want to be the guy who kind of shot Bambi like that and do it. But, you know, you'd like to think that a modern referee would have stepped in there after four or five rounds of that and said, okay, that's enough.
Yeah. Sorry, John, I asked Ian to cut you off there.
No, not at all. No, I was just going to say about the Angelo Dundee thing. I caught up with Angelo when he was, you know, years after that, when he would still happily talk all day about Muhammad Ali, who he, you know, I mean, he was still in regular contact with him right the way through his life. And I sort of said to him, you know, why did you stop with him? Why did you, you know, when everybody knew he should have finished and should have been out of there, why did you continue to train him? And he said, and he just sort of said, well, Ali was his own man and he did what he wanted to do. It wasn't people making him do something. He wanted to do it. And I think Angelo kind of thought, well, if I don't do it, who will? And I'm the man who knows him, who cares for him. And he just decided to stay with him all the way.
Yeah, it's a tough. I think we've discussed this before on the podcast. It's really tough because, you know, if Angelo walked away, then someone else would have been doing it, and they wouldn't have had that same bond with Ali. Someone always fills that breach in boxing, unfortunately. John, you did say as well there that about how Ali discovered he could take a punch. There was a great quote, wasn't there, when he came back, or long after he came back, I think, from the 3-year hiatus. Where it might have even been Ferdy Pacheco who said, you know, one of the best things he's discovered is that he can take a punch. This is in his return. And then he said, unfortunately, one of the worst things he's discovered is that he can take a punch. And he sort of obviously ended up relying on that heavily for a long period of time. I agree with you guys. I would have liked to have seen it, you know, to go out after the Thriller in Manila. What a way to go out. Would have been phenomenal.
It's like being in the near room to death.
Yeah.
I mean, Eddie Futch pulled Frazier out, but I don't think Ali could have gone on too much longer either. I mean, I think he was so relieved, wasn't he, when they cut the gloves off Frazier that he didn't have to fight another round because it was, you know, the big question was which of them were going to go first. They're both out on their feet. I mean, it was savage.
Yeah. It's a staggering fight when you watch it before you even factor in the heat and the conditions and everything else of Manila. So I've got here, obviously, you know, there's been a lot of great literary work on Ali. Some of the finest books in boxing are about Ali in the sense that he's transcended the sport so that we've now got some great sporting books. John, is there a particular favourite that you have on Ali?
I think Houser's is the definitive work, isn't it? So I think his was probably the best. I liked the book about the Rumble in the Jungle, which was just called The Fight. I thought that was a great piece of writing. You know, there's been books about him, but there's also been wonderful writing about him actually as a fighter and as a human being. You know, I mean, I think some of McIlvany's work on Muhammad Ali was sensational. I remember him doing a think piece for Sports Reports on BBC Radio. I'm sure Ian would remember it as well. And it was just brilliant. It was McIlvany speaking for about, what, 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes maximum about Muhammad Ali. So it's sort of 400 words. But what Hugh put into writing about Ali was just breathtaking. And I think he was, you know, that was one of the great things about Ali, wasn't it? That it prompted great writers to want to be there and want to find fantastic words to describe what he was doing.
And he loved the British press as well. Oh, and when I turned up to cover that one fight I covered of Ali, that Larry Holmes fight, and turned up at the gym and rather amateurishly sidled up to Angelo Dundee while he was working and saying, could I get an interview at some point during the week with Muhammad? And he shouted out to Ali, hey, we got a guy from the BBC here. We got a guy from Britain. And Ali stopped what he was doing, saying, we're going to talk to the man from England. The only place in about boxing. We've got to talk to the man from England. There was all these people there in the so I had to sort of fumble and get my tape machine out and basically let him talk. It wasn't an interview, it was Ali talking while throwing jabs that ended about a sort of half an inch from my chin, imaginary jabs. So he loved the British guys, especially. He knew McIlvenny, and I think he visited Reg Guthridge when he was in hospital. And I remember Colin Hart telling me the story about how him and Ken Jones had missed some flight connection, and they were going up to Deer Lake to miss the press conference, and got there in the middle of the night and asked the security guy, you know, and said, look, we're late. We've missed it all, you know. And the guy said, instead of saying, you'll have to come back tomorrow, sorry, he said, okay, I'll just go and wake him up. They woke up Ali, who knew that it was like the British guys there, and he came out at like sort of 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, sat there with them for about an hour. They got better quotes than the other guys had got at the press conference. You know, they got another great story. So, that was one of the things with Ali, and one of the great stories with Ali. I mean, John mentioned Hugh McIlvenny and all his great writing, but this is probably a bit non-PC, but I think we can do it. When he fought Joe Bugner, afterwards Bugner had lasted the distance with him in Kuala Lumpur, and Andy Smith, Bugner's manager, was holding court and saying, look what Joe's done today. Look what Joe's done today. He said, you know, he could fight Jesus Christ himself after that. And standing at the back was McIlvenny, and he just drolly said, only because you've heard he's got bad hands.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, some great stuff. I think so. I've actually written down 4 different books that affected me at different times. There was one by Howard Bingham, who was Ali's personal photographer, which really imprinted on me early days. And it was Muhammad Ali's Greatest Fight, Cassius Clay versus the United States of America. Really good about that period of time on Ali's life. There's The Brilliant King of the World by David Remick, which was a
Very good.
One of the excellent sports books, and you've obviously mentioned Thomas Hauser's Definitive Life and Times, which is another one of the greats. And then there's our old friend Bob Mee, who wrote The Ugly Bear and The Boy Who Would Be King, about the rivalry between Ali and Liston, and it's a really really good read. And actually, it's probably got some of the most interesting Liston stuff in there as well, talking about Liston's humble origins in the Deep South. Really good stuff in there.
Yeah, I mean, I forgot the Bob's book as well. We shouldn't have forgotten Bob. He's our mate. But yeah, all those books you mentioned. Yeah, the Hauser one, of course, is almost like it's like the Ali Bible, isn't it? Really, it is. You know, with all, and the Bingham stuff is amazing too, because he was so very very close. He was there almost for every second of it, wasn't he? So yeah, some incredible stuff written about him. I mean, I remember Bob Mee talking about him. He went to visit Ali's brother when we went to Louisville to cover Tyson and Danny Williams, Ruckman Ali. And I think Ruckman told him the story about when they were kids. You know, one of the ways he used to sort of try to practice to dodge punches was he used to get Ruckman to throw stones and rocks at him, you know, which was kind of crazy. And he'd be dodging them, you know. I wonder where he got the speed.
I was talking to my brother about this podcast last night, and saying we were going to do it. And I said to Peter, I said, do you remember when we were little? I said, I used to spar with you. I used to pretend I was Muhammad Ali, and you had to be whoever Ali was fighting at the time. And he said, yeah, I do. He said, I do remember. He said, and I've just about forgiven you. 3 years younger than me, and I'd been Muhammad Ali beating up my little brother. It was really, really quite unpleasant looking back.
What's my name, Peter? What's my name?
Yeah. I heard it was your superior footwork, though, really, John. That's what I heard.
Yeah, well, I think it helped that I was about a foot taller as well.
Yeah.
I was only disappointed, John, that the story didn't feature you throwing rocks at him. But
yeah.
Anyway, I know we don't do this dream match stuff too often, but I mean, obviously Ali fought the cream of his generation, and that's one of the reasons why his record holds up so well under any kind of scrutiny. But how would he do with the giants of the last 20-odd years? Vitaly and Vladimir Klitschko, Lennox Lewis in particular, who they had a great mutual appreciation for one another, didn't they? And of course, now with Tyson Fury. I mean, it's a different world, isn't it? It's a different time. These guys would be outweighing him by 60-odd pounds. And it's, you know, he's a cruiserweight today, really, Ali. Ian, I saw you sort of, you know, it's a tough one, isn't it? It's a tough one. Yeah. You can have all the skills in the world.
Yeah, I'm not a great fan of this cross era because, you know, all those old heavyweights, you know, Dempsey, Ali, Joe Lewis, etc. Yeah, they were all, as you said, blown up cruiserweights, really. Maybe even a bit less than that in some cases. So here's my very romantic view: Muhammad Ali would have outspeeded them all and had the chin to have weathered it against their huge size. So Ali wins on points, dancing around them, especially the I'm talking about the pre-1967 version.
Okay.
He beats them all up speed. And, you know, all right, he wasn't known as a huge puncher, but my goodness me, you know, he could hurt you and his precision was incredible.
Okay. And John, before I come to you with the same thing, Ian, just to follow on from that, if you could watch Ali against anyone in history, any heavyweight in history, obviously they did this computer fight with Rocky Marciano, didn't they? But if you could put him in with a Jack Johnson, a Joe Lewis, a Rocky Marciano, who would you have liked to have seen him in with? Or even a prime for prime v. Larry Holmes?
Well, I never saw enough of Joe Lewis. I've seen plenty of film of him, but you know, my top three was always Ali one, Joe Lewis two, Larry Holmes three. So I'm going to say Muhammad Ali against Joe Lewis.
Okay. And John, going back to you, I mean, I've given you a little bit of time to digest the Giants question of your Klitschko's, your Lewis's, and your Furies. Is there any way that the Ali of that time and age stacks up with these guys, or do you think he's just too good, or do you think he just would have been bigger?
I think he'd have found a way. I think with modern conditioning, he'd probably have weighed a stone more and would have you know, sort of used greater physical attributes than he did. But I think he'd have found a way. I think the fact that he was just so quick, I think would have given any heavyweight fits. And I hear what Ian says about Joe Lewis, but I think Ali would have been simply too quick for Joe. I mean, Joe was a ruthless finisher, and he was clearly an outstanding fighter. But I just think Ali would have been too clever for him, and he'd have been way too much for Rocky Marciano, too big, too fast. You know, that wouldn't have been a fight. The Klitschko's, yeah, I just think that technically they were too limited. And you know, I mean, I'm sure if he was listening to this, Tyson Fury would say, well, I could do everything that Ali did and I'm bigger and he couldn't have lived with me. I think he would have lived with him. I think he'd have found a way, and I think he'd have just been too clever.
Yeah. And well, how about this for a fight? Well, I'm thinking about it. The 1960s. Muhammad Ali against the 1987-88 Mike Tyson. That was a ticket or two.
For me, that's the one, Ian. For me, that's the one. I love that fight. You know, and I think, like John said, you know, the speed set Ali apart, but then Tyson's speed set him apart massively as well. And I think that's a mouth-watering fight. And do you know what? I think maybe in terms of fight for fight, the one that I might... And it's only now I'm really just thinking about this from the conversation. I suppose this is the why you have conversations like this. But in terms of what could be a terrific 15-rounder, can you imagine Muhammad Ali against a peak heavyweight Evander Holyfield?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Holyfield was afraid of nobody, and neither was Ali. I think that's an important factor when you talk about him potentially fighting a peak Mike Tyson. There's no way that Muhammad Ali would have been intimidated by Tyson. And I just think he'd have been, I think it'd have been just too fast for him. He could fight on the move. He was lightning fast footwork. And Tyson never came across anybody like that.
He was great, Ali, wasn't he? Kind of almost while he was fighting, he could change strategy in mid-fight, almost as if he was somebody watching the fight at ringside and analysing it and thinking, okay, this isn't working, now I'll try this.
And
great,
you know,
strategist.
In terms of being ringside, the only times I ever laid eyes on Muhammad Ali in my life were ringside. And he was the only times I was in the same room as him were when Layla fought on a Mike Tyson undercard in Detroit. And then I was there when the daughters fought, when Ali's daughter, Layla, fought Jackie Frazier up in the Turning Stone in upstate New York. And I saw Ali then. And it was he was obviously a decrepit older man by that point. He'd been decrepit since the, you know, I think it's fair to say since the mid 80s, given the battle scars from the fights he'd had. So we're talking around about 2000 now, 2000, 2002. But there was still, he might have been frail and he might have been older, but there was still very much a larger than life thing. Like, this is Ali. It was almost like he had this force shield around him, this bubble, this sphere where, you know, he wasn't one of us. He was different. It was Muhammad Ali, and it was something I won't ever forget. You know, just being in the same room as him. There was no conversation, and you know, I'd love to say there was, but there wasn't. Ian, was it like that when you met him down on the downside, where you saw this guy as still larger than life?
I was in the same room as him at a thing with Lennox Lewis, the EA Sports, who do the FIFA game and things like that. And they were launching something in London, and Ali was there with Lennox, and there were a lot of photos with Lennox, and a few of us were invited into the room, and I got to sort of shake his hand, and I said, it's a pleasure to meet you. And I did have that, like you say. You know, you feel like you're in the presence of some kind of messiah. And he, you know, very slowly, because I think it was his 59th birthday at the time, on that day. And we all said happy birthday. And I said, happy birthday, Muhammad. And he said back to me, this is the only conversation I kind of ever had with him other than that interview in Vegas. And he said back, I'm 90 today, laugh and laugh. And I said, well, I make it you were about when you won that Olympic gold medal then. and he laughed. And, so I think, you know, despite the fact, you know, that he was in that sort of, you know, horrible state, you know, and who can forget him lighting the Olympic flame in Atlanta? Do you remember that? And the reception that he got for that, like he was shaking, but he lit the flame. The aura he had around him. It was something to behold.
Well, in many ways, John, you might be right. You might know better than me, but that 1996 moment with the flame, that was in many ways a rebirth for Ali, wasn't it? Because he'd been sort of almost out of sight, out of mind for a while. And then there was this terrific rebirth, which carried on with him until his final days, where he really became the icon again.
Yeah, and I was there when he lit the Olympic flame in 96, and it was just an amazingly emotional moment. And he was, you know, in that, he was dressed all in white and visibly shaking with the effects of his Parkinson's, and lighting that flame was just an amazing moment. And I think if people had forgotten him and then become a little bit uncomfortable about seeing him, I think seeing him there doing that in the Olympic Stadium, people realized that although he was physically diminished, he was still the same superstar, and he still had the same extraordinary courage to be willing to put himself in the world spotlight to do that. And yeah, you're right, Trez. I think it was a rebirth in Muhammad Ali as a worldwide iconic sporting figure.
Just to think, none of it might have happened if it had been for that Henry Cooper night. in 1963, which, you know, he probably changed the course of heavyweight history, maybe for a while.
You guys knew Henry better than me. You guys knew Henry better than me. Was Henry did he feel shortchanged by what happened that night?
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, I worked with Henry many years later. Yeah, I think he did. You know, it's fable, isn't it? Now about the slit glove and all that stuff. People have kind of timed it again since and think it was sort of greatly exaggerated. But there's no question. You know, had the bell not rung, Cooper wins the fight. There's no question. I mean, you know, he was down and dazed and out of it. If that had been in the middle of the round, there's no way he'd have got up and got through the round. Not at all. And then, you know, they extended the break between the rounds and he cuts Cooper up in the fifth round and it's over. But yeah, but he goes on from that to become the heavyweight champion. So
Henry Cooper and that.
Really top domestic European level fighter, wasn't he, with a great left hook.
That business about the extension between the rounds, Reg Guthridge told me, John, that did not happen. He said there is no way it happened. He said his argument was that Angelo had come up with this idea to increase his mystique. Henry went along with it because it was a good story for him. But he said it did not happen. And he said, check out the radio commentary. So I dug out the radio commentary from that night, done by a guy called Simon Smith in 1963. And it didn't happen. There wasn't the change of gloves. It was only a matter of 3 or 4 seconds extra time between rounds. So it's something which has gone into boxing mythology, which, well, unless somebody, when I think it's highly unlikely, has found that radio report and edited it and taken something out, I think that proves that it never happened.
Well, maybe there's another podcast we could do just on Ali myths, because obviously I think I'm still not 100% sure that he did throw his Olympic medal off the bridge, and I'm still not sure that he didn't ever forgive Joe Frazier. I think there's a lot of myths that have gone with Ali to the grave, and I think it's fascinating because obviously, you know, there's still a hugely, hugely discussed subject now all these years on. Ian, it's cliched, Ian, isn't it? But there's not going to be another Ali or anything even remotely similar to him, is there?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you never say never. You don't know, do you? But times move on, and maybe because, well, John and I, not so much you, Tris, or of a certain generation, it was the thing that lit the flame for me to follow this sport. You know, he and he alone really got me interested in boxing. So, I mean, everything that happened since in his career, it's a story, you know, like they say, it's a story you couldn't or wouldn't dare write. But how this guy, you know, that's the other cliche, isn't it? That you, at his peak, you could have dropped him anywhere in the world and they would have recognized him, you know, more than the Pope, more than anybody else. You know, and there he was ahead of all those people in the, you know, greatest sports personality of the century vote, not only by the BBC, but by Sports Illustrated as well, ahead of Michael Jordan and Babe Ruth and Pele, Bradman, Gretzky, you know, go on with all the great sportsmen of that century. No argument. Muhammad Ali, number one.
John, can you add to that? Or is that Ian summing up all of our thoughts?
I think that kind of puts it in a nutshell, doesn't it? I was at that Sports Personality of the Year when he was given that award. And my goodness, what a moment that was. You're in amongst all the great and the good of sport, and everybody was in awe of the man. And he came in there and he was given this award. And yeah, it was one of those very, very special moments. And you talk about Lennox Lewis, you know, I mean, Lennox was I've said before, in my opinion, he's been the greatest heavyweight of the time that I've actually been working as a commentator and as a reporter. But Lennox had extraordinary affection and respect for Muhammad Ali. And I think the fact that he placed him on a pedestal kind of, well, for me, it means that we all should. And I was right and Ian was right in recognizing this guy as somebody just superhuman who was just inspirational to both our careers.
There's a great line, isn't there, right at the end of that Thomas Hauser book, The Life and Times of Muhammad Ali, where it's reflecting, and there's an Ali quote, I think, along the lines of this, where people, like he said, well, people keep asking me, look what boxing has done to you. And I reply to them every time, what would I have been without boxing?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of up, doesn't it, in a way? You know, the story does have the tragic element of his deterioration medically and of him going on, obviously, too long. But, you know, a lot of the American fight reporters, and when we used to go to Vegas, told me the story, and I heard it from more than one of them. The guys who were around, you know, and followed his career, the older American fight beat reporters. And they said that a lot of the damage was accrued because he would go into the gym for fights and not like most fighters lose a bit of weight first before he got to the sparring. He'd go straight into sparring. And in those early days in training camp, he was getting hit a lot more than he would ever have been if he was properly fast and sharp. So he acquired a lot of that damage, apparently, in gyms. But, you know, it wasn't just like the Holmes and Frazier fight.
True. Well, guys, look, let's put a bow on it today. This has been a lot of fun. They always seem to last about 10 minutes, although we've been going for an hour. It's always a lot of fun. I did just want to read out a couple of reviews, actually, just to encourage people to go over to iTunes and give us a rating review. Captain Space Rod, his headline actually is, listen to it now, as in buy it now, like my book Warrior. But Captain says, Chris has pulled off a real coup in bringing these two doyens of boxing broadcasting. I mean, I think it was John who pulled us all in. But anyway, the chemistry between them makes the time fly by as they take us for a wonderful walk down memory lane with some razor sharp lines and fascinating insights into big boxing stories down the years. Thank you, gents, and keep up the good work. Denman the Sheep says, great day off. Listen to all of the episodes in a day. Awesome way to spend it. I mean, that's hardcore. And then another one, 10 out of 10. Such a good combination with Tris, John and Ian. So many stories and all the info to back it up. Couldn't recommend it more. And then one more. Here's actually a suggestion for us from In Character, a must for all boxing fans. I have an episode idea. Best boxing press conferences. One of my favorites was Arthur versus Yard. Pat Barrett versus Tunde Ajayi was entertaining. By the way, this is an excellent podcast. Good shout there for press conferences.
We'll maybe do that.
But gents, as always, a lot of fun. I seem to say it every time, but the time absolutely flies by with you two. Great company. Really enjoyed it as always. And that was great stuff on Ali, given our comparatively meager dealings with the greatest, but he's made an impact on all three of us, it's fair to say. We hope we've made an impact on you listening. If you have enjoyed it, please go over to iTunes or Spotify, rate and review this podcast. Gents, thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful. We'll be back next week.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.